They would say that they're just trying to protect themselves in case the Republicans are ever in charge. But I would say if the Republicans were in charge, they'd say screw the Democrats and do it anyway. Glenn, thanks for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
They want to hit a Thanksgiving song. All right. All right. This is a Thanksgiving song. I hope you enjoy it. Love to eat turkey. Love to eat turkey. Oh, I love you. Cause it's good. Love to eat turkey like a good boy should. Cause it's turkey to eat. So good. That clapping's messing my head up, man. I appreciate it. But I was trying to think of the next line. I'm like, all I hear is clapping. Here we go. Thanks anyways. Turkey for me. Turkey for you. Let's eat the turkey in my big brown shoe. Love to eat the turkey at the table. I once saw a movie with Betty Grable. Eat that turkey all night long. 50 million Elvis fans can't be.
Thank you. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Native American Youth and Family Centers Micro Enterprise Program, presenting the Naya Marketplace, where Northwest Native small businesses, vendors, and artisans display beadwork, jewelry, poetry, and more. Saturday, December 7th from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. at 5135 Northeast Columbia Boulevard. Information at nayapdx.org. Vendor information by email to cjw@nayapdx.org. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Androids. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com. And now the evening news.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to help co-sponsor the Triangle production of American Fiesta, starring Gary Wayne Cash. A witty, hopeful tale of imperfection and acceptance. American Fiesta will take place at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. This Triangle production will run from November 29th through December 22nd. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up in the KBOO Evening News, World Trade Talks break down in Geneva.
Protesters prepare to boycott Walmart this Friday.
Timber communities and conservationists are weighing in on Senator Wyden's ONC lands plan. Good evening. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, November 27th, 2013. I'm Jemai Cherry.
And I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
Native American activists and their supporters will gather at Alcatraz Island tomorrow to commemorate Indigenous Peoples Day. Alcatraz was once the nation's most notorious prison, but has been abandoned since the mid-20th century. Tomorrow's Indigenous Peoples Sunrise Gathering commemorates the 1969 to 1971 occupation of the island by Native American activists, known as Indians of All Tribes. Andrea Carmen, the executive director of the International Indian Treaty Council, spoke with KBOO Radio today about the action at Alcatraz, which takes place each year on Thanksgiving Day.
A few years back, we decided to stop calling it Un-Thanksgiving and call it Indigenous Peoples Thanksgiving Day, because we have, as Indigenous peoples, a lot to be thankful for. We have survived genocide, and we still have our dances, our songs, our language, our ceremonies, and we have our families and our nations as well that are continuing to stand up for our rights and protect our sacred sites and ways of life. So that we have to thank our ancestors for those that stood up under the most oppressive conditions you can imagine. My own grandmother survived a massacre in 1912 on the border, Nogales, and I'm not alone. A lot of our families went through that kind of trauma, but we also have a lot to be thankful for. We have our children and our grandchildren, and we have beautiful circles like we're going to have tomorrow on Alcatraz Island around the sacred fire with the dancers, the drummers. We're going to be honoring those that are still with us that stood up and were part of the occupation at Alcatraz in 1969, young college students and young people, most of them, that sparked the movement that has taken us to the United Nations and helped us to stand up for our rights internationally. So I was a college student myself in those days, and it changed us forever in the ways of the way we're looking at our struggle and what we've been able to accomplish. So all those things we're going to be giving thanks for our Mother Earth and the abundance and the gifts she still gives us on a daily basis. And we invite everybody to come out and be part of that circle, but also dedicate ourselves to continued struggle in defense of our lands and our treaties, our ways of life, our sacred places and a better future for all of our future generations. So with that, I want to invite everybody to be out there around 4 a.m. At the pier to catch the boats and to join our circle and dedicate ourselves to continued struggle for Indigenous people's rights.
That was Andrea Carmen, the executive director of the International Indian Treaty Council. KABU also spoke with Lenny Foster, one of the original occupiers of the of Alcatraz Island.
I'm grateful for this opportunity to share our thoughts, my thoughts, with the event scheduled for Thursday morning at Alcatraz Island. And it will be a very spiritual and historic event to commemorate the resistance and the occupation of Alcatraz Island 44 years ago. Myself, I participated in the occupation as a young college student in 1970. So it's been 43 years, and I've been trying to support this event every year when they have this event. And it's been an ongoing process of passing the torch and a commitment to the younger generation, our children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren. So in that manner, I think it's very historic also that the treaty rights and human rights of our Indian people, Indigenous people, are not forgotten. It was a symbolic gesture on the part of the Indian people in the Bay Area that Alcatraz represented the federal government. It was declared surplus land in the treaties that were signed between the Indian people, particularly the Lakota people of South Dakota had signed the treaties with the United States government in 1868. And in that treaty, there were certain provisions that any land declared surplus would be given back to the Indian people. And they saw that Alcatraz Island was no longer being used as a federal penitentiary in 1963. So it was laying idle in the Indian students at San Francisco State College, the community of San Francisco in the Bay Area, and the UC Berkeley students decided that they would do a symbolic occupation of Alcatraz in November 1969. They united and occupied the island, and that lasted for 18 months into from November 1969 to June 1971. I myself participated several times. One particularly that stands out in my mind was December 1969, when I hitchhiked from Fort Collins, Colorado, where I was a student at Colorado State University, and I hitchhiked out to San Francisco. It was predominantly young Indian people, so it was very hard conditions, and the commitment that was made carries on to this day. What began at Alcatraz Island in 1969 bloomed and started a movement that went worldwide, and started an Indigenous movement that resulted. One of the end results was the Declaration of Human Rights for Indigenous People that was done as a result of all the different issues. Many peoples came together and discussed what were some of the concerns and the issues and the human rights that were being violated of Indigenous people throughout Western Hemisphere. All began with Alcatraz Island, so it had far ramifications.
The action at Alcatraz Island will take place tomorrow morning at sunrise.
A new poll shows that Americans preferred diplomacy to war by a margin of 2-1. The poll was conducted by Reuters along with the independent marketing company IPSOS. It found that 44% of Americans support President Obama's recent nuclear deal struck between Iran and six other superpowers. Only 22% opposed the deal. A separate poll carried out by the Washington Post and ABC found that 64% of Americans support the nuclear deal with Iran. A researcher involved in the Reuters poll said that the results speak to war fatigue in the U.S., where after 12 years of continuous war in the Middle East, the American public has little interest in furthering military intervention. The poll's findings are rare good news for President Barack Obama, whose approval ratings have fallen significantly in recent weeks due to the troubled rollout of his health care program.
Plans for a national boycott against the retail corporation Walmart are set to begin Friday after the Thanksgiving holiday, which officially marks the start of the holiday shopping season. The boycott has been called by trade unions Our Walmart, an organization of present and former Walmart workers who are demanding higher minimum pay and improved working conditions. Kasai Dier reports. Looks like we might get some audio for that a little later.
Walmart has also been the subject of a report published today from various consumer advocacy groups. The report examines the company has been collecting massive amounts of data from its customers. It claims that Walmart may have data on as much as 60% of Americans and can be unfairly used as a form of discrimination. KBOO reporter Jemai Cherry spoke with Kim Lemkuhl, one of the producers of the report.
So we put this report together with the hopes to release it before Cyber Monday, right, the biggest online shopping day of the year. And we think it's really important to let everybody know the way that Walmart and a lot of retailers invade the privacy of their consumers. They do it easily, secretly, and they don't really have any accountability. Walmart's particular privacy policy is 3,200 words long. And to give you some context, that's about 10 to 12 pages of text that is impossible for any reasonable consumer to be expected to read or to understand. But if we don't engage with what that privacy policy is telling us about what Walmart is up to, then we're actually paying a really heavy price for that low-cost merchandise.
So walk us through this. You're saying that it tracks in several different ways. What are some of those ways?
Right. So they'll track us through its website, Walmart.com. They also have a couple of smartphone apps through social media pages. They have in-store Wi-Fi. If you ever notice that you'll connect to that while you're kind of killing time in the store, maybe waiting in the pharmacy or something, they can see physically where you are in the store, information about your phone. And they also have, of course, old-school in-store cameras. So there's this added element of physical surveillance combined with the big data mining, and that's matching individuals to their data across devices in the way, you know, from your phone to your tablet to your laptop to your office computer in a way that kind of browser cookies that we're all somewhat familiar with can't do. And they're actively seeking to make predictions about all of us over time. And they do that by generating even more data about you, what is called personally identifiable information that may or may not be correct. So an example is we know the horror stories that happen with credit ratings, for instance, that are inaccurate. And they drive decision-making by lenders and by employers and other things that are sometimes impossible to correct or to even know that they're happening. And they have these discriminatory outcomes. So you can imagine Walmart has all of this data on you, which may or may not be accurate, and then they can sell it or give it to anybody that they please, and there is no laws or regulations against that kind of data sharing at this time. Like, the laws just really have not been able to keep up with those technological advances.
And tell me about the scope of this. How many people is this affecting, or is it something that is only... they're only tracking certain people, or can you tell a little
Sure.
more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So Walmart's obviously the biggest private employer in the United States, and they have a massive number of customers. They claim to track the personal data of more than 145 million Americans. And we know that they're sharing that data with at least 50 third-party companies at this point. It's a really frightening and growing threat to our privacy, and we can foresee discrimination against people with this information. There's, like I said, there's no rules that that regulate this, but on top of that, there's really no way for you to opt out. So even on your smartphone, like with an app, if this freaks you out and you want to go home and delete your Walmart app, that information never actually comes off of your phone. There's no way to get rid of it without actually throwing your phone away, which is pretty scary.
And real quick, you had mentioned that in the report, it says that people of color and other marginalized communities are at risk of discrimination. Now,
absolutely.
So what are some of the ways that, I guess, consumer, what are some of the steps that consumers can take to protect themselves from this type of data collection?
Right. So the tricky thing is there's really nothing that we can do right now. If Walmart is not going to take direct action to be more transparent about what they're doing and make some improvements for consumer safety, we're urging the Federal Trade Commission and Congress to do so. We're particularly concerned, and why we were involved in this project, is that we know that communities of color and low-income folks in particular are disproportionately at risk with this type of data mining and surveillance. So, you know, some hypotheticals that are not too hard to foresee is what happens if Walmart decides to sell your data to banks that we know over the past several years have this history of making subprime loans, or to insurance companies that are trying to increase their profits by discriminating. Telecom companies have a history of redlining poor communities. And we also have this history in this country of government agencies that are racially profiling. And we've now heard about AT&T selling all of their data to the federal government. In other cases, not even selling it, just giving it away. So we're concerned that we've become this sort of captive consumer base with not very many options. There's no transparency about what's happening, and we currently don't have any control over where our data goes or how it's used.
Thank you very much, Kim.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And that was Kim Lemkuhl of colorofchange.org. And to find out further information, you can check the report on that at the website colorofchange.org.
We also have the audio of the U.S. Walmart boycott that's going to be taking place. Kasai Dayer is going to report on this.
The retail giant Walmart is under pressure by its workers and consumers, who say that the company has unfair labor practices and doesn't pay its workers enough to live on. On Friday, a series of planned protest strikes and boycotts against Walmart are set to take place across the nation to officially mark the beginning of the holiday shopping season. Trade unions and organizations such as Our Walmart, which is made up of current and former Walmart employees, have initiated the planned actions. I spoke with Bob Marshall. He's an organizer of the Food and Commercial Workers Union here in Portland.
There's two sides to it. There is the community support and accountability side, which holds Walmart accountable for bad business practices, from everything from, you know, building in a marshland to forcing the taxpayers to pay for Walmart workers' health care because they're too cheap to pay for proper wages and health care. So that's called... The community accountability side is making change at Walmart, which is building coalitions around the country and sponsoring the demonstrations and doing press conferences to educate the public about how Walmart is basically scamming the taxpayer and not contributing to our society properly, more than they take. In other words, a lot of predatory business practices. So that half of the campaign is called Making Change at Walmart. The other half is the worker organization that associates who work in Walmart, workers, are forming, called Our Walmart Organization, United for Respect. It's not a union because we have some pretty goofy and screwy repressive laws as far as labor goes in this country, and if workers were trying to form a union, it puts some legal time frames and restrictions on the workers that they don't have.
Do you know if there are any plans for coordinated wildcat strikes by Walmart workers to coincide with this nationwide campaign, particularly starting this Friday or throughout the holiday season?
Yes, there are. Not here in Oregon, to my knowledge, but around the things develop unevenly in different states. And last year there were, I think, 250 or something workers who went on strike and 26 different cities or something, like I was saying, an unfair labor practice strike. So, yes, that'll be happening across the nation. I don't believe it's going to happen here in Portland or in Oregon, but you never know. It might. People get fed up and walk out the door. By the way, speaking of labor law, if I could make a comment, the National Labor Relations Board just issued a complaint against Walmart, which means they're going to look into it and investigate the fact that Walmart fired people illegally who went out on unfair labor practice strike several times during the last year, retaliated against people by disciplining them and so forth. So they flaunt the labor laws and are getting caught up in it. And the National Labor Relations Board issued a complaint against them. I believe it was last week. for a whole bunch of violations.
Describe the typical workday for Walmart employees on Black Friday.
Well, it's pretty chaotic, obviously, because it's a big sales day for all major companies and retail in the country. And in general, Walmart workers don't get enough hours to survive. That is part of the demand for Black Friday, is end the illegal retaliations, provide a minimum of $25,000 a year, and offer more full-time work. So they have a lot of part-time jobs, and they claim they pay everybody $13 an hour, but that's if they're full-time, and that's a real small percentage, I'm not sure exactly what, of the workforce. So,
what's behind the internal food drive organized by management so that employees can drop off food for needy colleagues?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. It's really indicative of not only privatizing the profit and socializing the cost, meaning Walmart throws the cost of health care onto the taxpayers to the tune of over $1 billion a year for the average store, the average Walmart store, for workers who get food stamps and health care, and nobody's putting them down because they are trying to find a job and feed their family. The average cost, I believe, is over $800,000 a year to taxpayers subsidizing each store, right? So in general, Walmart has perfected the art of privatizing the profit and socializing the cost of doing business. And you're right, I think about a week ago they came up with a program that is just outrageous, insulting, and disgusting. They're asking employees to buy food and give it to each other because Walmart is too cheap to pay them a living wage.
That was Bob Marshall, an organizer with the Food and Commercial Workers Union here in Portland. And this is Kasai Deer with KBOO News.
Forest Grove residents will face a rate increase for the cost of sanitation. Service provider Waste Management asked the city of Forest Grove for a close to 8% across-the-board rate increase to cover a dip in profits. The city opened a review to find out the reasons and justification before it hosts a public hearing next month. I spoke with Paul Downey, Forest Grove's finance director, to see what some of the findings of that review revealed.
Yes, on October 7th this year, Waste Management requested a 7.7% rate increase across all classes of services. The reason they asked for the rate increase is they are projecting their rate of return for the franchise operations in Forest Grove will be about 3.1% this year. And that's below what most cities use for an acceptable rate of return for franchise operations. Most cities use a minimum of 8% and a maximum of 12% for a rate of return. So since they're dropping below that minimum of 8%, they decided to ask for a rate increase. And they figured the 7.7% rate increase would get them roughly about a 10% rate of return. So that's why they came and asked for a rate increase.
Had that rate of return, has that been like on a steady decline, or is this just an odd year coming up for them?
The rates of return in 2009, they had an 8.1% rate of return. In 2011, they had a 10%. 2012, they had a 4.7%, and 2013, they're projecting a 3.1% rate of return. So it's gone down the last couple of years.
Okay. And has there been any analysis that's been done as to like what their operating expenses or any particular reason why their rate of return would be dropping?
We took a look at some of their costs. Some of their wage costs have been going up, and some of their disposal costs, which they don't have a lot of control over, have been going up. So it's been mostly wage increases and disposal costs, which have been increasing for them.
There's going to be a public hearing, is that correct, on December 9th?
Yes, City Council scheduled a public hearing on December 9th to consider the rate increase.
And what discussion has the city had, or what discussion will they be having at all prior to the hearing?
Well, at the council meeting last Monday night, which was the 25th, the city manager and I presented the findings of facts to the city council. Basically, we have to present a report to them where we discuss the potential rate increase, what staff's recommending, and ask them to schedule a public hearing. So we presented our findings to the city council, and staff is recommending a 4% across the board rate increase. And so the city council scheduled a public hearing for December 9th to consider that amount.
So aside from just the residents paying more, what would this rate increase mean for the city?
They're not going to be providing any more service. I mean, at the moment, they already provide, we already get weekly recycling yard debris and glass, so they're not going to be adding any services at the moment. It's just a rate increase to help them cover their increasing costs and get their rate of return back to what would be an acceptable level under the terms of the franchise.
And have there been any other utilities or franchises that have had requested this in the past? Or
basically, the only franchise operation that comes to the city for rate increases is Waste Management. Television franchise goes through the Metropolitan Area Communications Commission, and the other, Northwest Natural Gas, is regulated by the PUC. The city has its own electric utility, so we handle the electric rates internally with my staff.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Paul.
All right.
That was Paul Downey, the finance director for the City of Forest Grove. And this is Jemai Cherry with KBOO News.
With Governor John Kitzhaber at his side, Senator Ron Wyden unveiled legislation on Tuesday to change the way Oregon's O&C lands are managed. It aims to appease rural counties that want to log more timber and conservation groups that want to protect public land and wildlife. At first reading, neither group is sold on it.
Senator Ron Wyden debuted his long-awaited plan for managing Oregon's O&C lands to mixed reviews on Tuesday. It adds protection for some parcels of land and older trees, while at the same time clearing the way for what some are calling ecoforestry, and others say is clear-cutting. The plan would increase annual timber harvest among the 18 O&C counties to more than 300 million board feet, when it's about half that now. Tommy Howe, with Oregon Wild, says his and other conservation groups are disappointed, and they think that Wyden was under significant political pressure to allow more logging.
We see Senator Wyden as an environmental champion, but we just must strongly oppose this bill because it is so heavily weighted towards clear-cut logging and weakening environmental safeguards.
The bill streamlines the environmental impact statement process for timber sales and allows a very limited time window to challenge a sale in court. Senator Wyden says he wants to achieve sustained timber yield to help Oregon's rural economy. Conservation groups say these counties depend too heavily on a volatile timber market, and that land doesn't always have to be managed for resource extraction to bring value to an area. Douglas County Commissioner Doug Robertson, who leads the Association of O&C Counties, says rural Oregon is trying to attract new businesses, but it's been tough. In the meantime, he says they'll put Senator Wyden's proposal under the microscope to see if they can provide any reasonable level of funding for the counties.
We live among some of the most productive, valuable, low-elevation forest lands in the world, and they're simply not being managed. We watch them burn up. We watch them become susceptible to insect infestation, disease, windthrow, and so on. And people are sick and tired of it.
The Association of O&C Counties already backs another bill by Representative Peter DeFazio, Kurt Schrader, and Greg Walden. That would place about half the O&C land under state control for timber harvest. Wyden's bill keeps it all under federal management. In conjunction with the Oregon News Service and KBOO News, this is Jemai Cherry.
And now we hear from the latest of the worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Some Whole Foods workers in Chicago are staging a one-day strike today to demand a fair system of scheduling that will allow them to enjoy Thanksgiving like millions of other Americans. They're being joined by the Workers Organizing Committee of Chicago, our Walmart, and other community allies. Whole Foods worker Matthew Camp says that retail workers are facing what he says is a disturbing trend of having to work through Thanksgiving and other holidays that used to be sacred time off to spend with family. Camp says this is why Whole Foods workers in Chicago are striking today.
The day before Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving, which of course is an incredibly busy day for a grocery store, essentially to make these two points. One, that this tendency among large retailers is very disturbing, you know, that we feel everyone's entitled to this holiday. And secondly, that we include ourselves in that first proposal, that we also, having worked so hard for the holiday, are entitled to for time to travel, to see our friends, to see our families.
This strike for better schedules and holidays off is within the context of a larger struggle at Whole Foods.
We're organizing with the Workers' Organizing Committee in the Fight for 15 campaign for better working conditions, a better attendance policy. We don't have sick days at Whole Foods, and for better wages as well. That being said, this particular action, the day before Thanksgiving, is really something of our own design. We were inspired, as Whole Foods workers, we were inspired by the Our Walmart Black Friday strikes that have been going on for the past couple of years.
Supporters of comprehensive immigration reform are working to intensify political pressure on Republican U.S. House Speaker John Boehner to act on immigration reform. Since November 12th, SEIU's Eliseo Medina, Dreamer and Mi Familia Vota's Christian Avia, and Dae Jung Yoon have been fasting in a Fast for Families tent on Washington's National Mall. Reverend Samuel Rodriguez has been fasting for 40 days. They vow to continue their fast until they can no longer physically sustain it. A major new nationwide effort by civil rights, faith, and immigration reform groups is being launched to continue to push for comprehensive immigration reform with a path to citizenship. Pope Francis on Tuesday said capitalism is a new tyranny. He called on world leaders to act to address poverty and growing inequality. In an 84-page document, the Pope said some people continue to defend trickle-down theories that assume free market economic growth will bring greater justice and inclusiveness in the world. Pope Francis said that's never been confirmed by the facts, and meanwhile, the excluded are still waiting. He said under this capitalist tyranny, the powerful feed on the powerless. Thanks to hundreds of listeners and some labor unions who responded to our emergency funding appeal, Workers Independent News is still here in Madison, Wisconsin, putting workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To make sure we stay here, become a solidarity sustainer by donating now at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You are listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned for an interview with activist Jim Powers about the upcoming Megalode protest in Umatilla after this newscast, followed by The Underground, a show by the KABU Youth Collective at 6. Tonight's theme for The Underground will be about the 1960s. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is forecast to be partly cloudy with a high temperature of 53 degrees. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are counts per minute in North Portland is 32 with a high of 49, and Sitka, Alaska has a radiation count of 35 counts per minute with spikes up to 60. EPA alert levels start at 10 CPM. More information can be found at radcast.org.
It's 5:38. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
In this season of the fall harvest, Congress is proving once again that it is a very poor gardener. It keeps watering the weeds and pulling the flowers. A conference committee is presently meeting to hash out a new five-year farm bill, and what a hash they're making of it. For some 40 years, one of the best flowers in the farm bill garden has been the food stamp program, a symbiotic benefit for poor people and farmers alike. Since the crash of 2008, that flower has been especially worthy, keeping millions of knocked-down families from plunging into full-tilt poverty. Yet, with joblessness unabated and poverty increasing, $5 billion was cut from food stamp benefits on November 1st, and the House now wants to yank $4 billion a year more from it and subject recipients to drug testing and other gratuitous intrusions. Meanwhile, the same gardeners are watering the farm program's noxious weeds. Specifically, they're growing a $14 billion a year crop insurance subsidy that amounts to a guaranteed farm income for the largest, most profitable agribusiness operations. Indeed, while the House wants to force food stamp recipients to prove that their incomes are low enough to qualify for benefits, The crop insurance handout requires no means testing and has no limits on how much recipients can get. This means that billionaires who are only incidental farmers will be among the biggest beneficiaries. And those billionaires are to be given one more little Benny. The Farm Bill would let them get their subsidies in secret, preventing taxpayers from knowing who gets how much. This is Jim Hightower saying, you should not be punished for being poor, and you shouldn't be subsidized if you're a billionaire. To help plant some seeds of common sense in American farm policy, contact the Environmental Working Group. That's the Environmental Working Group at ewg.org.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Free speech rights scored a victory in Colorado this week when a judge ruled in favor of a housing justice advocate and against a state legislator who tried to obtain a permanent restraining order. Darren O'Connor began a campaign in May to hold Denver area Representative Angela Williams accountable by being vocal at a number of her town halls, inquiring why she withdrew her support for a bill that might have protected homeowners from inappropriate foreclosure. O'Connor spoke with KBOO's Robin Ryan about the ordeal, the decision, and where the fight for housing justice goes from here.
A judge has decided in your favor by denying state lawmaker Angela Williams a restraining order. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. It's nice to have had that outcome.
How did the judge explain the basis for the ruling that was made?
She went through all the charges and who we were, and then she said, despite the fact that neither the plaintiff or defendant's attorneys brought up the First Amendment, that this was clearly a First Amendment issue, she cited case history nationally as well as here in Colorado, some cases where people were challenging legislators or city council persons. And she said in some of these cases, one was Seth Brigham in Boulder, Colorado, where I'm from, that the person had been quite vocal and disturbed city council meetings. And still the court had decided on his behalf because political speech is a First Amendment right. She then said Mr. O'Connor's efforts that have been called into question are clearly political speech, that unlike Mr. Brigham in Boulder, that Mr. O'Connor has been characterized even by Representative Williams' own witness, a Commander Kahlo from District 2, as being respectful, well-spoken, and a gentleman, and that Representative Williams should really have handled this a different way.
Can you go over why she became the focus of your actions?
Representative Williams is the chairperson for the Business, Labor, Economic, and Workforce Development Committee. And that committee heard House Bill 13-1249 this year. That bill was the Mortgage Accountability and Housing Stabilization Act. And when it first was released for review, I went to a town hall of hers, and I was very heartened to hear her speak for it. Almost immediately after that, Representative Williams began sending out emails that were really negative about the legislation, whereas when it first came out, she was very positive about it. She suddenly started finding flaws with it. So I've been pushing on her ever since.
Were you expecting any form of legal ramification for taking such consistent steps when you were served in October?
I did not. I have always, in my communications with Representative Williams, been very careful to let her know that this was about the issue, that this was all about foreclosures and her failure to represent Coloradans. I guess you could say I was aware that it could happen and that I needed to convey that awareness, to convey that this was not a personal attack. And I think I was very effective in doing that, and I think the judgment came out in support of that. She had no reason to fear for her safety. And in fact, Representative Williams has a degree in criminal justice, so I really think that she knew exactly what she was doing. She was really trying to stifle any voices against her action, and she, quite frankly, abused the justice system for her own means.
Can you let our listeners know what the next step is in the campaign for housing justice?
We have many fronts here in Colorado. We work with the Home Defenders League nationally as well. We're in support of, for example, the city of Richmond's use of eminent domain. We're part of a Open Records Act Freedom of Information request to the FHFA to find out what Ed DeMarco has been doing, because Fannie Mae has been foreclosing with aggressive behavior and rapid rate recently as he's looking at the end of his tenure at the FHFA, and they refused our request. So we're going to, it looks like, be a party to a court case against them that'll take place in California.
Darren O'Connor, once again, congratulations to you, and thank you for the work that you do. For folks wanting more information or inspiration on how they can take action against housing injustice, do you have a website you can direct them to?
I do. You know, the easiest one to remember is OccupyDenver.org. And on that page, there's a link to the Colorado Foreclosure Resistance Coalition.
That was Darren O'Connor from the Colorado Foreclosure Resistance Coalition speaking with KBOO reporter Robin Ryan.
A community activist and leader in the city of Selma, Alabama, was arrested Monday during a city council meeting protesting against the construction of a monument honoring the founding member and grand wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, Nathan Bedford Forrest. Faye Rose Turay has been in the Selma County Jail since Monday and has refused bail in protest against the monument being put up in the section of the city. Turay and others in the council meeting were refused to allow to express concern about the plans for the monument. Here's a clip during Faye Rose Turay's arrest.
They co-founded the Friends of Forest together. Friends of Forest is an organization formed to honor a Klansman. Do y'all know what that means? Do you know the impact that has on black children?
I've had about all this.
Why don't you challenge it? Can you reveal yourself today? People, you know who she is now. She's a segregationist. She belongs to the country club. And every one of these white people that belong to these segregationists, we should not support them.
That was audio piece of Faye Rose Turay's protesting against the construction of a KKK founder, a monument to a KKK founder in Selma, Alabama. Turay's bail is set for $1,000, but she says she'll remain in jail until the plans of the construction of the monument is ceased.
Delegates involved in the 159-nation talks in Geneva do not agree on a proposal some would like to see approved next week in Bali, Indonesia. The World Trade Organization supporters say an agreement might boost the world economy by $1 trillion and create 21 million jobs. If those numbers, from a report co-written by Jeffrey Schott, a senior fellow in international trade at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, are correct, why would delegates fail to reach agreement? The Trans-Pacific Partnership, our more geographically limited deal on trade being negotiated in secret, is encountering worldwide grassroots opposition because many believe it would deprive citizens and governments of power, which would be transferred to corporations or pro-trade special courts and agencies. The mainstream media, in large part owned or financed by international corporations, is reporting failure and collapse of these WTO talks, with no context as to why people, even trade delegates, are reluctant to approve a trade deal some would say have tremendous benefits, millions of jobs, and up to $1 trillion. In many communities around the nation, people concerned about the downside of so-called trade agreements have been in demonstrations and light brigade illuminated sign actions, often featuring the internet searchable hashtag FlushTPP to encourage people to research and speak out on issues of international trade and fairness. Various nations, including India, have opposed the transit clause, a factor upsetting the talks aimed at sealing the first global trade deal since the WTO came into existence in 1995. Several developed and developing countries are against the inclusion of electricity grids and petroleum pipelines in the definition of traffic in transit. Some countries are concerned they might have to allow any member country under this definition to use the country's infrastructure for supplying petroleum and electricity. Coincidentally, groups of First Nations Indigenous people in North America are also concerned about and resisting the actions of megaload transporters, frackers, pipelines, and other resource extraction and pollution related to petroleum and transport thereof. It remains unclear how or how well the views of many groups such as tribal governments, environmentalists, ecologists, and climatologists were included in trade discussions generally focused only on what is called economic growth.
You're listening to...
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Marion Drake, Robin Ryan, Kasai Dier, Charles Johnson, and a special thank you to Sequoia Wright. The producer is Jemai Cherry, and our engineer is Ian Westmoreland. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard, you can find their information on our website. I'm Jemai Cherry.
And I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
Coming up tomorrow on KABU, on the morning at KABU, at 7 it's going to be a special Democracy Now! Featuring an archival program called Who Put the Rainbow in the Wizard of Oz? At 8, Teresa Mitchell hosts a special 2-hour talk radio program, A Day of Reparations. At 10, we'll hear a program from the series Wisdom of the Elders. At 11, Between the Covers features an interview with Margaret Atwood, who discusses her latest novel, Mad Adam, the third in her speculative fiction trilogy that began with Oryx and Crake, as well as the social and political ramifications of her work, with host Richard Walensky of the series Bookwaves. And at 11:30, Jen Chavez hosts The Film Show. Thank you, KABU members, for your generous support to keep KABU strong and vital. We appreciate your help. And stay tuned now for a live interview conducted by KABU reporters. I'm Jemai Cherry.
And I'm Aaron J. Bernard. Radio. You're listening to KABU Community Radio. I'm Aaron J. Bernard. We're speaking now with Jim Powers, an activist who has been participating in protests at the Port of Umatilla this week in opposition to the transport of a large piece of refining machinery out of the Port of Umatilla. Good evening, Jim.
Good evening.
So we're going to be talking about the megaload that's currently headed east out of Oregon, but first I'd like to take a minute to get everybody up to speed. So we've been hearing a lot of terms like megaload and tar sands project in the news lately, but how about a quick primer for our listeners? Fracking, tar sands project, megaloads, what are they?
Well, there's a huge reserve of fossil fuels in Alberta, Canada that is an extraction of what's called tar sands oil, and it's a very dirty kind of oil in the sense that it takes a lot of energy to create oil from it and then ship it down pipelines or on trains. There's enough carbon in this oil field to basically blow the carbon budget for the entire planet. As you know, those who've done the math know that we have somewhere under a trillion tons of carbon that we can release, humans can release in the atmosphere forever. And we're well past the halfway point. This would just blow the budget. So these megaloads are equipment that's being shipped up the Columbia River, and then they're looking for way the oil companies are looking for ways to get this equipment into Alberta, Canada, and it turns out that Oregon and Idaho have the flattest roads that they need to use to get this stuff up there. I mean, a megaload is truly awesome. We were standing by it. It's if you can picture basically 900,000 pounds of material, so that's about 1 million pounds. If you're standing on a football field, this thing is almost 400 feet long, so it takes all the way through the football field. It's 24 feet wide and about 20 feet tall, so it's just a huge object. And they want to move it through the roads of Oregon. They've been moving these through the roads of Idaho and Montana, but court cases have slowed them down there, so they're now hitting the roads of Oregon.
So you were at the port earlier this week for a protest, is that right?
Correct. They move Sunday night. They move on at night. They have to move on the highways between 8 at night and 6 in the morning. So we were there, about 20 people, at night in 23-degree weather. Protesting the first scheduled move was Sunday night for this first megaload in Oregon. Fortunately, it didn't roll, so we got to actually get some sleep.
So a Hillsboro-based hauling company named Omega Morgan is responsible for supervising this transport. Have you seen any indication that they might be open to any kind of dialogue?
We haven't had dialogue with them, and I think we should. The problem is, the classic problem here is capitalism. I mean, their business is to make a profit to move this equipment for General Electric, as I believe the general contractor on it. I'd love to have that conversation with them, and hopefully we can in the near future. In the meantime, we've got these loads headed down the highway, now scheduled for next Sunday. Those who would like to join us are certainly welcome to come out. We're doing everything we can to try to halt that. We're looking at legal options. We're looking at more protesting. And definitely we'll talk to Omega Morgan, but I don't give us a lot of hope of turning around their business model right away. I think our best option is to try to slow them down and try to make slow them down enough that, you know, it doesn't become profitable to move these loads, and then I think they would stop.
So is that what you're hoping to accomplish with the second protest?
I think so. I think if what happened in Idaho was there were enough protests, they slowed enough of these projects down, they got injunctions in court, and eventually they couldn't run on most of the roads in Idaho. So we hope to accomplish the same thing in Oregon. If Omega Morgan won't, on their own, stop shipping these, then we will try to stop them in various legal ways. They go through sensitive salmon reclamation areas. They go through tribal lands of the Confederate tribes of the Umatilla. Part of our beef, as the news has covered, has been that ODOT did not have a very open process for deciding to move these gigantic pieces of equipment on our roads. And, you know, really, if you stand by one of these and see how big they are, they're just the antithesis of what Oregonians, I think, care about, which is nature and, you know, the web of life. And these things are just the antithesis. There were some complaints when they finally had a hearing. I mean, they had a hearing scheduled for basically a day after this thing was supposed to actually move, which is interesting. But anyway, the people who did show up were complaining. I mean, people in small towns, these things go through about 20 towns on the way out of Oregon. They have to make amazing turns on very tight roads, and there's questions about how much damage they could do to the roads. So we have problems at many levels, from the micro level of We don't need to be producing more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Any infrastructure that increases the ability to release more carbon is insane. I have grandchildren. This is going to affect them. It will cause climate change. It will accelerate climate change. This is something we can stop. We need to stop it. It shouldn't be going through Oregon. At the smaller levels of problems, it's roads can be destroyed. Gravel can wash down into sensitive areas for salmon, not to mention the drivers who get to wait 20 minutes at a time for these loads to pass. So we see problems at virtually every level with these loads, and it's a travesty. I don't think if Oregonians had time to think about it, they'd want these passing on our highways. I mean, we shouldn't be renting our highways for the fossil fuel industry. If we could pass a law not to allow them to pass, I would support that. We won't get that, but at least we can try to work with the state and see what we can do to limit the access.
So are there any other specific comments you've heard from the people in the community surrounding Umatilla?
People came out to, they're awestruck by the size of this thing. They wonder how it will even get through the roads. Some people who were at the evening event that we were at watching this thing were commenting that they were, you know, really against it moving. There hasn't been, you have to realize this thing happened really fast. We heard about it last week. The permit wasn't issued till 5:30 Friday night for a load that was scheduled to leave at Sunday. Now, that's not a lot of public comment period. We never saw a copy of the permit until 5:30 on Friday. So there was very little time for people to organize. We felt pretty good about getting 20 folks from Idaho,